Absolutt. Oi, det var veldig høy lyd. Is everyone here? Did we lose someone on the way from the other room? Okay. I think we'll start now and just continue talking about different services and tools that incident response teams can use. So incident analysis, in order to do analysis, you need to have something to analyze, right? So that's why you need to have some collection of evidence. And it's really difficult sometimes when you have an incident and you figure out that, oops, we don't have any logs for that because we forgot to switch on the logging of that particular system. And that's something that I've seen in incidents. And that's really sad because then usually that means you cannot get into the bottom of how you got compromised because you don't have the required evidence to do any analysis on. And you can't really track or trace or figure out what was the root cause of your incident. You can have incident response on-site, which means that you either your team is in the same place as where the incident is happening. So you just directly assist someone to recover from an incident. Or you can support someone. Maybe if you have a distributed centralized team and you have an incident in one of the branches, you can assist and guide the victims in how to find evidence, how to recover from an incident. So sometimes that means that you instruct someone like the IT personnel where the incident happened to gather the and collect the evidence, tell them what type of logs they should collect, what type of files they should be looking for, and so on. And then they might send you the evidence and you might do some remote assistance or remote analysis and then give them more instructions on how to handle it or how to interpret the data. So that's two different ways of doing incident response. Or you could have this mobile team that I mentioned, that you have a go bag and you just send out your team to the place where the incident occurred and they do the response and do the analysis on site there. Incident response coordination means that you need to coordinate and keep track of what everyone is doing in the incident response. Who is involved and what is the communication needed for all the different parties. Usually it includes the victim of the attack, maybe other sites that are involved in the attack in case this is an incident that's not on your site. Also, whoever is requiring assistance to analyze the incident. It could also be other parties, like IT support of the victim, internet service providers, other CSERTs or other CERT teams, and maybe the local system and network administrators. Also, you might need to respond to or need to coordinate your response to any communication with the legal department or some legal counsel that you might need to hire in, or human resources, public relations. So human resources, typically, if it's an insider threat, someone inside the organization that has done something that they shouldn't, you might need to involve HR. Public relations in case you get some media attention, you need to be prepared to respond to media. And also maybe law enforcement in case you press charges or maybe you got notified by law enforcement about the incident. How do you handle vulnerabilities? That's part of the reactive services too. because you will get information about new vulnerabilities, and that's sort of after the vulnerabilities occurred. That's why we put it on in reactive services category. And whenever there's new information about vulnerabilities, you need to analyze your organization and figuring out how these new vulnerabilities might affect you. And then develop your response strategies into detecting and repairing. As part of this, there's one concept that I haven't put on the slide, but that can be really helpful. It's something called a software bill of materials. Have you heard this expression before? No? So whenever you're using in your IT systems, usually you will have a lot of different things that need to be maintained and patched. So you need to have an inventory of all your IT assets and all of your software and hardware that you're depending on. And sometimes you also, this software again uses open source libraries that can have vulnerabilities. So you will get a report about a vulnerability that is in one of those open source libraries that is in one of your products. You can get this from the product manufacturer if they are good in their customer relationship and pushing out this information. But sometimes you get it only from the open source library. You only get information about this library that is part of a product. And you might not know that this is inside a product that you're depending on. If you ask your vendor for a software bill of material when you purchase something, they need to list all the different libraries and all the different things that are within their product, all the different software that's being used. And if you have this complete list, it's possible for you, when you get new information about new zero days, new vulnerabilities, to check if you actually have this in your environment, in your systems. So that's a kind of, sounds a bit boring, tedious to maintain all this list of assets and things, but it can be really important in case you get another heartbleed incident, for instance, OpenSSL zero day. That was a couple of years ago. I guess some of you remember that. There was a lot of different products that used OpenSSL inside of their products, and there were possibilities of exploiting this. So that's part of the vulnerability handling, and it's actually a reactive service because you will need to worry about this as soon as you know about the new vulnerability. And when you get the reports about vulnerabilities, how do you categorize them? How do you figure out if this is how severe this is? There's one system that is used today. It's been used for quite a while, called the CVSS. This has come out in different versions. So this is the latest one, the version 3. And it actually creates a score between 1 and 10 on how vulnerable, how severe a vulnerability is. So once you have a vulnerability, you can use this system to score it, to figure out if it's wormable or not, for instance, if it spreads by itself. That's one of the things you will put into there. So these are the factors that you rate on different scales, and there's actually a calculator that you can use in order to get this score. So whoever creates the vulnerability report will usually use this CVS scoring and then add this as one of the descriptions in the vulnerability notice. So we look into what is the attack vector, how complex is the attack, what kind of privileges are required? Do you need to first escalate privileges in order to exploit this vulnerability? Is there user interaction required? So typically, if you need to get the user to click on something, it's a little bit harder to get something to install than if you don't have to click anything. You just have to surf into a website, for instance, like a drive-by exploit. That's more severe than if you need some user interaction to get it to be installed. But usually someone will click. So yeah. What's the scope of the vulnerability? And what does it affect in your system? So you put in values for all of this, and then you end up with scoring. And the higher the number, the more severe the vulnerability. So now I'm going to go through how you do artifact handling. And artifact, that is in forensic language, any file or object that you find on your system that might be involved in probing, attacking systems and networks, and anything that's actually been used to defeat security measures. So an artifact could, for instance, be a malware file. So a file containing malware, that could be an artifact. But there are other artifacts too, like network artifacts, things that there can be toolkits, exploit scripts, and so on. So how do you handle artifacts? How do you find them, and what do you do with them once you find them on your system? So you could do malware analysis or artifact analysis, and that means a technical examination of the files you found in your system. You need to respond to them, and that means what should you do in order to get rid of the malware. So what kind of files do you need to delete? Typically, malware comes into your system packed in a packer, and it unpacks. It starts maybe communicating, downloads more files. It changes settings on your system, changes your configuration, hides itself in different ways. And so it's not only one file you should worry about when you detect malware on the system. Usually there's lots of other things you should also do in order to get rid of it. And then the last step is to coordinate your response. For instance, share information with other researchers, other search and vendors, and security experts, like write a blog post about the malware analysis could be one way of sharing information, or sharing it on other channels like I've gone through already. But typically, artifact handling or malware analysis takes some time. But luckily, there are some tools available that you can use to do some quick checks, that you don't have to start reverse engineering the complete binary in order to figuring out what this malware is doing. Some of you might have heard about VirusTotal. Have you seen VirusTotal? Yes, good. If not, just check it out online. It's a service where you can put in files or URLs, and it will automatically inspect the file or your URL and scan it with loads of different virus scanners, and will give you a list of what the different scanners detect this file as. It's not only for putting in files. You can also take the hash of a file. In case you have a file and you don't want to share the complete file, you can do a hash sum of the file and just like a SHA-1 or MD5 hash. And you just put in the hash of the file, and the VirusTotal will then search to see if it's seen it before. And if it's seen it before, it will display the result for that file. So that's a way of checking out if this is a common malware or not. Because there's not all files you want to submit to VirusTotal. Can some of you imagine why it's maybe not a good idea to put in any file you find on the system into VirusTotal? It is a very common way for a fresh IT administrator to do something that can go horribly wrong. What could possibly go wrong if you just find a file on your system, you suspect it's something strange with this file, might be an attachment to an email or if it's something you found on your in your folders while doing an investigation? No? So sometimes these files are highly targeted against your organization, and they can contain information about you as a target. So if this comes from a sophisticated attacker, they might have done a lot of reconnaissance before, gathered a lot of information about you, and then tailor-made an implant or an artifact malware for you. And if you submit this file and someone reverses it, this is before you've done your own reverse engineering, you just don't know what this is, and you submit it to VirusTotal, the file will be there in a database for other researchers to look at. So the file might contain really sensitive information, like a list of email addresses to all the different select targets in your information. Maybe other things that will out you as a victim of this attacker group. In other cases, the files might contain sensitive information about you or your customers. So you should be careful about uploading your internal company files to a service like this. So that's why I recommend that you do a hash sum and search for it first, to figuring out what kind of threat this is. So based on the results, you can also get like a first type of indication of whether or not this is a very targeted attack. So if a few antivirus engines, tools recognize this as malware, it's only been seen very few times before, you might suspect that this is something quite advanced. But if all the different antivirus engines detect this as a threat that they've seen before, and it's been submitted plenty of times to VirusTotal, then it's typically a more generic type of malware. There are other services too. TotalHash is another example of a malware analysis database. And they actually provide some static and dynamic analysis for your malware samples. So not only scanning them with all the different scanners, and they will also give you data like different hashes and different details about some network analysis too. Like what kind of network traffic this malware creates. Yara is another tool that is quite popular, and it's a way of doing a static analysis of malware. So in case you have a file and you want to search for different content in it, you can create Yara rules that will search for strings, and you can also put in different regular expressions, and you can add this with using some conditioning. So you could search for strings in different combination, like you need one of them or all of them, and you can make pretty complex rules. It's a way of maybe comparing different malware samples. Often malware you can have two malware samples that are very similar but that give different hash sums because they have been slightly altered, But if you do search for strings inside the binary, you can find a lot of similarities. And this is a way of grouping together different malware samples. And also, you can use this in a way of trying to track who is sending you, or trying to track the groups that created the malware. And it's a less expensive and time-consuming way of classifying malware without having to do the reverse engineering yourself. So you just create these strings or patterns or signatures and match them against the file. It's an open source tool that you can look into yourself too, if you're interested. So this is for static analysis, and that means that you're not really running the malware, you're just looking at the files and the binaries. If you want to do dynamic analysis of malware, typically you would do a sandboxing of it. It means that you will run the malware in a kind of closed or guarded environment and try to figure out what it does. And this is also useful if you want to figuring out what kind of network traffic the malware generates. And this can then help you to create intrusion detection rules to find the malware. Anyone of you tried Cuckoo Sandbox or seen Cuckoo Sandbox before? Okay. This is also something you can look into, and it's open source, and it's an automated malware analysis sandbox that gives you quick answers. So you can do like a preliminary quick malware analysis into this, and it's actually quite advanced, and it does give you information about like the general behavior of the file. What does the file do? What kind of API calls does it perform when it runs? It can dump network traffic and analyze network traffic even when it's encrypted. You can take screenshots with this tool, so you can see what is actually displayed on the screen when the malware runs. And you can also do some pretty advanced memory analysis of an infected virtualized system with this, because it has some integration with Volatility, which is a tool for memory forensics. So take a look at the Cuckoo Sandbox if you're interested in malware analysis. Okay, so typically also all these tools that I mentioned were used in different ways by NorCert and CERT team when I worked doing incident response. So the proactive services, that's the announcements of alerts and warnings and security advisories that you should pay attention to, and watching and monitoring new developments and things that should be included into your threat analysis. Other proactive services that you might perform in the CERT is security audits or assessments, configuration maintenance, and other like security-related information dissemination trainings and talks. But these are kind of optional services. These are not the core services of a CERT. Also, quality management services can be performed by the CERT. And these are also not typically the core incident response services that the CERT team does, but it can be used in different business continuity planning, risk analysis, and awareness building, training, and certification. Yeah, a lot of different services that can be performed by people on the CERT team, because usually you have pretty skilled people on the team that can also do other tasks. So when you actually start doing the implementation of the CERT, of course you first have to hire and train the staff, which is kind of sounds like an easy step, but it can take quite a while. It's not so easy to find the right people. And then purchase equipment, prepare their network infrastructure, define their policies and procedures, decide on an incident tracking system and how to report incidents and how to actually get incident reported to the team too. And once you have the CCert in place, you announce the operational CCert, spread the word about the team, and hopefully your clients, your customers will contact you when something suspicious is going on. So easy things like you should perhaps have a dedicated website where all the contact information and so on is listed. And once you have the team up and running, also the last thing that you should include is to evaluate how effective is your team. And there are different ways of doing this, but you could, for instance, look for benchmarks and ways of comparing your team to other teams. It's a little bit difficult, though. Statistics on, like, for instance, number of incidents by a team can usually, it's not very easy to find metrics that are very comparable between different teams. So you could ask your constituents for their comments. You could send out surveys to them to gain insight in how your customers think you're performing, and then also keep track of different measures, like how many incidents are reported, what are the response times, or how quickly do you resolve incidents. One thing that's kind of important here is to keep in mind that the number of incidents is not a very good measure of the effectiveness of your team, because you would think that a high number of incidents means that your team is not doing well enough in being proactive because they're not stopping incidents from happening. But that's the wrong way. Actually, the more incidents you get, the better, usually, your team is performing. Because that means that you're better at detecting things that are actually happening. Because before you had the team in place, you probably had a lot of incidents going under the radar that you didn't see or didn't detect, didn't respond to. And now, when you're starting to actually have your eyes and ears open, you see what's going on, and then incidents start happening. And as you gain more trust with your customers and also with your collaborating partners, you get more information sharing happening. And that also usually triggers more incidents to be detected and responded to. So that means that not having a CCert team in place usually means that you're not seeing everything, and now you have a team, you start seeing things, and as you get better and more effective and gain more trust, you get more and more reports incoming, and you get more and more incidents. So that's a kind of dynamic that you should expect to happen. And then you will reach a threshold where you get too many incidents that you cannot really handle, and you need to change your procedures, and you need to change the way you're working in order to still be able to deliver your services. So you might have to filter out more incidents as your team gets more and more professional. Okay, so I think you can use some minutes to actually try to get some more interaction going on there. I feel like I'm talking. So I want you to discuss a little bit with your neighbor, so two and two. So for those of you that sit like alone in the back, maybe you can try to move closer to each other. So let's say that you are in charge of contingency planning at NTNU. In the last 6 months, the IT staff has been forced to work in a small and inconvenient office due to renovation. A few months ago, the website of NTNU got defaced. At the same time, a series of DDoS attacks started happening. And the issues with the web server and the websites have been resolved, but the DDoS attacks keep happening every week. And at the same time, a key member of your staff just handed in his notice. What should you do to counteract staff burnout in this situation? So 5 minutes to discuss with your neighbor, and then we take a short survey of what you came up with. Okay, so do you have any suggestions on how to counteract staff burnout? So did you come up with just one thing per per group. Yeah, so give team members the opportunity to take more breaks.
Not necessarily more breaks, but breaks stop when you actually need them.
Mm.
So when you feel burned out, you need a break.
Yeah, so before you get burned out, you need a break, I guess. Yeah. So let the managers keep an eye on their employees to see that they're actually taking breaks. Princess. Yeah, good. How about you?
Could you get the internet service provider to help you with the DDoS attacks?
Yeah, you could that. So if you can maybe get someone external to, you can hire in some consultants, or you could do more to try to resolve the DDoS problem. Yeah. That would also help, of course, because then you don't get this maybe you can resolve this problem. Mm-hmm. About you?
Same as him.
Have more members on the team? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Team building.
You think that team building will help in this in this stressful environment? Yeah, maybe. I just saw some research actually that said that team building doesn't really work that much. But I guess team, whatever lifts the team spirit, whatever helps to lift the team spirit would help. Like, for instance, celebrating wins for the week before the weekend or something like that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so maybe purchase some services that could help with the DDoS attacks, and also flexible working hours could be a possibility that could help with stress. How about you two?
Pizza and coffee.
Pizza and coffee, so more fuel. Okay. How about you? Yeah, so try to make a prioritized list of tasks so that you don't feel overwhelmed of all the tasks, and someone is given leadership on what is most important to do first. Yeah. Yeah. So, and also, don't have managers that have too much hope in what their employees might be able to do, and hire in external consultants. Yeah. How about you two in the back? Did you discuss or come up with something? Yeah. Okay, good. I think you almost found all. These are some things that I thought about. So budget increase could be something. Ensure that everyone has enough availabilities of their technical references and can get updated, and maybe considering giving team members different tasks if they're getting a bit burned out on what they're doing currently, rotating them, maintain sufficient staffing, mentoring programs is a very good thing that can help if someone feels that they don't have enough skills or they're struggling with the task they're doing. What typically is a good thing is to take one very experienced team member and pair the experienced team member with a junior or newly hired person so that they can work together and explain. So the mentor is explaining what he or she is doing, and the other is team members learning, and often it helps to be two persons looking at one problem and discussing it. Can be work better than just having one person doing the task, and at the same time you will create more robustness in case your senior team member quits, which could happen if it's too stressful environment. bringing outside experts you mentioned, and also to have some simulated incident handling exercises could actually also help the team spirit a little bit. So give them some fun tasks, not only the tedious same tasks all the time. Okay, I think it's time for a break again. And in the break, I will go and get a prize for the Kahoot quiz that we'll have at the end of next lecture. So you can look forward to that. So see you 4:15. Okay, I think it's time to start again. I let you go 2 minutes early before the break, so let's start now. Okay, I do have a lot of slides still to go through, but I really want to make time for the Kahoot quiz at the end. And I made an extra long Kahoot quiz this time with 10 questions, so we need to have 10 minutes maybe for it. So that means I need to skip through a bit faster some of my slides and leave it up to you to read them or read in the book. And I think maybe the part, like details of information of intrusion detection systems is something that you can read around or that you already had covered in some other subjects. Is that correct? IDS? IDPS? Okay. So I'm going to skip a bit fast through those slides then. But I really want to show this figure. It's from a resource that I put on as extra reading on your syllabus. It's a free book, ebook from MITRE called 10 Strategies of World-Class Cybersecurity Operation Centers, which I think is really good. And it's a bit updated when it comes to processes that are used in the teams. And this shows a typical process of incident handling of how a security operation center works. It shows on the top where incidents and events notifications come in. So you can get it from your you can collect security relevant events from your systems. That's one way of getting information about suspicious events. You can get it from your constituents. Someone is filling out an incident report or phoning you or sending an email. Or you could actively hunt for threats in your network. So you don't, you're sort of assuming that things are happening that you don't get notifications of, but you can try to find them anyway. So threat hunting, which is kind of a fun thing. And this is something you can do by looking into like a different system for analytics and trends. You have people that actually monitor logs and look into your CMs and sensors. And someone that thinks outside the box analytics. So you need to be creative in order to find new threats. And all this should go together in a system where you analyze and you have lots of data sources and you use different tools and people to find, do in-depth analysis and find the incidents. And then once you have found incidents or got reported incidents, you actually do the tie to the next level of decision making on how to respond to the incidents and what kind of actions you should do. And at the same time, do coordinate with the other system owners and admins and also collect evidence and start to do the in-depth analysis. And here's another graphic from the same ebook, also showing how you can collect and analyze artifacts and data from different systems, and how you should also categorize it and handle it. So you might want to have a separate malware repository where you keep all the malware files. Typically, you don't want to have malware files in your production environment. So you don't want to save them in your normal file shares. You want to have it a separate repository for that. Also, you have different analysis tools. You do network monitoring and capture of network traffic. and you have the log monitoring going on, which can be both real time, but also looking at trending and visualization correlation of things going on in the log, in the logs. And here you need also people. You can't only rely on the tools. So people will never get replaced by tools in incident response. You cannot do fully automatically find the threats and respond to the threats by only tools. Okay, so I really encourage you to read that book. It's really good. Some of it has also been put on the syllabus, some chapters. So it's a good supplement to the course textbook, in my opinion. But be aware that they have put the word SOC everywhere. So you don't find CSERT or CERT, but you find the SOC terminology. And it's sort of a little bit different than the CERT team in many cases. But there's a lot of the same things. A lot of the things that the SOC does is usually considered part of incident response services. So what is an incident? I think we've been through this before. This is the way that NIST defines it. As soon as you have an incident, you can also classify it in different categories. This is some examples of categories that can be used. You could have one category for denial of service, one for malicious code, one for unauthorized access, inappropriate usage, and you can have a mixture of all of this. And this is also the way that the categories are defined in the course textbook. But there are different ways of categorizing incidents. Incident indicators can also be categorized in different classes, and that's depending on how much you can rely on the indicators, if this is a real incident or not. So the three categories are possible, probable, and definite, and they're also defined in the course textbook. And here are some examples of the different categories. So what could be possible indicators? So these are the least reliable indicators. It could be presence of unfamiliar files, unknown programs, processes, unusual computational resources consumed, or that the system just crashes. But all of this can also have very natural explanations, so it doesn't necessarily have to be a security incident that caused this. But it could be in some cases. Probable indicators, they are a little bit more reliable. For instance, activities at unexpected times. If users start logging in and doing things on your systems at times where they should be sleeping, could be very strange, but it could also have a natural explanation, of course. Or new accounts that you weren't expecting. Of course, reported attacks could also be an indicator of incidents, but doesn't always have to be an incident. Reporters are sometimes wrong. And in this category are also notifications from intrusion detection systems, or CMs. So they are all also not always definite. The definite indicators, that's when you know that something is actually causing a security incident. If dormant accounts start to be used, like someone that worked for the company before and quit, and you just forgot to, or system administrator was lazy or forgot to wipe out the account, and this account suddenly starts doing things on your system, that's a definite indicator. Changes to logs, like deletion of log files or entries in log files, the presence of hacker tools, that could also be a little bit, that could be debated actually, So if you say that this is a definite indicator of an incident, it means that you sort of not allowing hacker tools to be on your system at all. And for instance, your malware analysts may need to have hacker tools on their system. So you need to be a little bit careful how you define this. But if someone installed hacker tools that shouldn't be there, that's probably a hacker. But not always. Notification by partner or peers or tip-offs are usually very reliable indicators. It means someone has investigated another intrusion and they found traces leading to or evidence of you also being a victim of the attack. Or notification by hacker, that also happens. Could be, for instance, in a blackmail or extortion attempt. Some alternative indicators, these are more general, can also be used to define an incident. And identifying real incidents is really the clue here. You don't want to have false positives or false negatives. And typically, you will get a lot of false positives if your intrusion detection system is not properly maintained or configured. And also, if you sort of have your policy where activities that should be allowed are not allowed, for instance. So we don't want to, especially false negatives is something that we should avoid. We don't want someone to break into the system and we're not discovering it. So these are different terms for intrusion detection and prevention systems that I'm sure you've seen before. The biggest difference between IDS and IPS is that IPS can actually also respond or stop attacks. And this can be done in different ways, blocking, terminating connections, changing the configuration or environment, or doing other types of technical measures to prevent and stop the attack. And these are some terms that you should be familiarize yourself with when it comes to intrusion detection and prevention, what all these different things mean. For instance, you can do different types of clustering and filtering and compacting of alarms and alerts in ways that makes it more easy for analysts to actually look into the alerts. These are even more terms that you can read yourself. What's important to remember is the tuning of the intrusion detection system is really important in order to filter out noise, because otherwise you will just get a lot of rubbish and you will have a kind of false sense of security, because you either you don't have the capacity to investigate all the attacks, so you cannot see the real alerts, or you have tuned it in a way that you get a lot of false negatives. So both false positives and false negatives are bad in this connection. And you just take like snort installation out of the box and put it on your system and don't tune the rules, the rule set, you will get overwhelmed by notifications. So you really need to tailor it to your environment and your needs. And also it depends on where you place the equipment. And there are different ways of doing intrusion detection. It can be network-based, host-based, or application-based. So it's up to you to... I won't go into all the details. You can read yourself about the difference of these different types of intrusion detection systems. But what I think is important here is to think about the different tools and how they work on how actionable they are and how much volume of data you will have to analyze with the different tools. So you could do a lot of logging and a lot of analysis of your systems, but at one point you will have too much information to in order to use your resources in a good way to analyze it. So for instance, let's say you do a full session network capture, or PCAP, of all the network traffic that goes in and out of your network. It's going to be a huge amount of data. So of course, depending a bit on your network or and how big you are, this data, it will be a problem just to store all this data. And then how to actually make use of it. You will need to maybe look into big data solutions for that. So that could be too much data if you do it all the time. But of course, you will get a maximum amount of context because you will have all the network traffic. So you can find everything if you look for it. Another level or way of creating less data, amount of data, but still have a good visibility of what's going on in your network is to collect NetFlow. Do you know what NetFlow is? Have you heard about NetFlow before? Okay. So it's metadata of your network traffic, and it can be very useful in figuring out what type of network goes in and out of your network and who are you communicating with. You will get IP addresses for all the different data that is flowing in and out of your network. Audit logs are more at a complexity level above. And then you can look into malware and look into how the malware behaves in a sandbox, for instance, what kind of traffic it makes, what files it creates. And then you can look into host-based intrusion prevention systems, and then look into your CM alerts. And at the top is the network intrusion detection system alerts. Also, there's a scale here of what deserves immediate attention. So if an alert goes off up here, you need to pay more attention to it than if you have something suspicious among lots of data in this other type of data collection. Also, in case of anonymity and privacy, there are different the scale granularity here is where you have PCAP that captures everything, and you have intrusion detection alerts that only gives you maybe a small segment of the network traffic around the time that the alert went off. So you need to find the sweet spot where you have enough data to actually make sense of the incidents, but you don't get too many events per day so that your analysts and tools are overwhelmed. So you need to find this peak where you have the good enough amount of data that you can process and without exceeding your capabilities. So this is often a challenge when it comes to using tools in your environment. Okay, different detection approaches. You can have signature-based systems, anomaly-based, automated response, honeypots, and honeynets. So I'll go through some of these, but not in very much detail. What's important is that signature-based IDPS needs some prior knowledge about the threats, because you need to create signatures that capture the traffic, capture the suspicious traffic. And it needs to be constantly updated and maintained in order to be useful. So all the new threats you need to put into your signature set. Anomaly-based intrusion prevention systems, they create a baseline of the normal traffic, and then they look for suspicious events. It's important to know that they can generate a lot of false positives if they're not tuned correctly, But at the same time, you can also actually detect new types of attacks with this. With the signature-based, you only detect the attacks that you are looking for, in a way. Or attacks that are correlated to the ones you are looking for. When you look into the value of different intrusion detection systems, you can see that the value of the signature-based is only kicks in after the signature is implemented, after or when the patch is released and implemented, and when. So if you look at the lifetime of an exploit, the timeline of an exploit, you can capture it earlier with an anomaly-based intrusion detection system. Of course, you cannot get it from the start, because that's when someone creates a bug in a software somewhere, and that creates a vulnerability that can be exploited. But as soon as it's being exploited, it's possible if you have an anomaly-based system to actually detect it. So this is also a valuable illustration to look into when it comes to the difference between signature-based and anomaly-based. Then we have automated response, and that's systems that actually does some reaction to incidents. In some cases, this can be seen as hacking back, and that's a kind of controversial topic. It can pose some ethical problems if you start doing active response like this. Because it's not always the case that you can track correctly who is hacking you. And if you try to hack back automatically and do some active measures automatically, it means that you could commit an intrusion yourself in someone else's system. So that can be very problematic. So it needs to be handled with care, those types of systems. I want to talk a little bit more about Honeynets and Honeypots, because they are really useful when it comes to monitoring your network. And you can also use them as a kind of way of distracting adversaries and leading your attackers into a corner of the network that you want them to be, and you can study them. So you can use honeypots to be able to study the way attackers behave. And that knowledge can be really valuable when you're protecting your systems. And can help you to create signatures for your intrusion detection systems and create strategies for what to look for in your system. A honey token, anyone tried to play it with honey tokens or heard about honey tokens before? Yeah, one of you? So that's something that's kind of fun. It's a way of actually detecting that someone is messing with your system, that someone is inside of your files or inside of your email account or whatever. It's a file that you place there that no one should touch or read or do anything with unless they are someone intruding into your system. So it's a kind of trap for the intruders. A honeynet is the same as one honeypot, but you have a whole network of them. And they can be implemented in different ways. Some of them simulate large systems and are kind of made in a way that is hard for an intruder to discover that they are not on the real system, but on a dummy system. And they went into the trap. So if you want to play a little bit with honey tokens yourself, I recommend that you look into Thinkst Canaries. Also free to use, and it's kind of fun and easy to use. So it works that way that if an attacker accesses your token somehow, they give you an SMS or an email and notifies you that This has been accessed. So the tokens, they consist of a unique identifier. So you just generate them there by entering your email address and you get the token. And whenever this URL is requested, the alarm sort of trips and you get the notification. So how can you use this? How can you get someone to trip over your token? Any ideas? For instance, you could generate this token and put it in an email that you send to yourself, and you have a very interesting topic of the email. And then if so, then you don't open this email in your inbox, but if someone accesses your inbox and then look at this email, then they the token is accessed. Another way is to put it on your computer, and it will watch a file. And whenever someone opens this file, you will get a notification. So if you didn't open it yourself, then that's of course something suspicious going on. And it works both on Linux, Mac, and Windows. It uses different types of mechanisms to trip or to trigger the token. So I recommend that you look into that one. Whenever you're deploying honeypots, it's important to know that you can enter kind of entrapment or enticement situation where you're luring someone to commit a crime. Not with this honey tokens, but if you set up a honeypot. If you're interested in honeypots, you can look into honeynetproject.org, which is has a lot of resources on that. But keep in mind that in some countries, this type of active or this type of luring someone into your network can be questionable in terms of the law. Okay, so once you have incidents, it's very important that you have some procedures in place for deciding what to do with your strategy for handling the incident. That means you need to have a situational awareness. You have a lot of information that you gather. You do analytics. Maybe you also represent it in a visual form. And that's when we come to the OODA loop: observe, orient, decide, act. So you need to act and decide on how to handle information incidents based on reliable information. So first thing you do is to validate what happened, what did actually happen, and then figuring out what does this mean to you, your organization, and then what is the response? What are the actionable events? And that means that you need to manage your logging and data collection activities. Be prepared to handle a lot of data in this and have some tools and systems that can help you in it. Be aware that sometimes logs rotate. Means that old logs get overwritten by the new ones. And you should be aware of how long period of time you are logging, and maybe you should also archive logs so that you have a longer time to investigate, because often in some types of incidents the intrusion happened a long time ago, so you need to have old log data. Encrypt logs, because logs are also sensitive information, and dispose of them securely when there are when you don't need them anymore. And monitor your network for unexpected behavior. And that's a lot of things that should be monitored, not only logs. But look into all your different network error reports and look into your statistics, look into any kind of anything that can indicate suspicious behavior. And when you do this, you need to notify users of the extent of monitoring that is being done. And that is also for privacy reasons. Sometimes companies put in place systems that decrypt encrypted traffic, like SSL inspections or deep packet inspection. And this can be actually kind of intrusive into the privacy of the users. There was an article about this that I read recently on DG.no, where it was claimed that a lot of companies does this kind of monitoring without informing the employees, which I think the employees needs to be informed about this. And it's also possible to have whitelists of web pages that you don't include in the decryption of SSL traffic. For instance, all the different online banks, so that you don't end up getting your users' passwords for how they log into their bank account. That could be whitelisted from the packet inspection, for instance. But it's very important to review and look into different types of signs of anomalous behavior. And use your network mapping and scanning tools. Maybe check now and then for if you have actually patched all known vulnerabilities. And identify different types of user behavior that's suspicious. You should also monitor files and directories for unexpected changes. And this can be done by host-based intrusion detection systems. Hardware attached to the network is also very relevant with all this bring your own device that we have today. Employees are bringing in their own things and attaching them to the network, maybe even creating their own access points and sort of compromising the wireless network security of the company. So there are things that actually should, if you're in charge of security, you should make inspection rounds and look for hardware attached to systems like key loggers can be placed into USB slots and so on. So it's important to be aware that hardware is also a threat, not only software. So look into physical resources for signs of unauthorized access. And review any reports of suspicious behavior. These are different aspects of creating situational awareness and different ways or different categories that you should pay attention to. You should look for insider threats. You should have real-time monitoring. You should get threat intelligence. Also, reporting network forensics audits. All this can be put into a capability that gives you situational awareness. So proactive versus reactive detection is something that I want to talk a little bit more about, but I see I'm running out of time, so maybe you can read about this. It's different way tools that you use to actually try to detect incidents before they happen. And this is part of the threat hunting and the threat intelligence. And you can get data feeds from many sources, both closed and open and commercial sources. You can buy data feeds where you get a lot of threat intelligence and threat information. But you can also get this from different security organizations. What you get in these data feeds are typically IP addresses, URLs, domains, and things that are associated to malware. You should look for if you have network traffic against all these different domains. One way of doing this is something called passive DNS. It's a very useful tool in investigating incidents where you have infrastructure used by the cyber criminals or the threat actors that is complex. So it's not like one single IP address is creating all this bad traffic. It's kind of a large infrastructure that you need to pay attention to and investigate. Does all of you know how DNS works? Have you learned about DNS? Have you heard about passive DNS before? Okay, so good. So DNS works by, how this is how the name servers operate. So when you want to look up an IP address, you first ask your recursive name server if they don't have it if it's not in their memory. If no one's asked about this domain for a period of time, it will have to start asking out to the different the hierarchy of name servers to get the correct IP address. And what passive DNS does is to sniff or to collect information about all the DNS queries. It's important to notice that this is not done in the first level from the user to the first server. It's done in the server-to-server communication. That means it's more anonymized, and it's a lot less traffic collected. And how can it be done used in incident response? So typically, you can use it to investigate, for instance, malware that comes via a phishing email. It will contain a phishing domain. And this has an IP address, and that's really interesting to look into. But what can be found in the DNS database, the passive DNS, is other domains that has the same IP address. Maybe they are also associated to the same threat. And other related IP addresses and other name servers with other associated domains. If you keep looking and tracking, you will get a large, out of one IP address, you can get a lot of information that can help you reveal the adversary and also gain more threat intelligence and awareness of the threat. So these are the results from a survey that was done some years ago among the different certs, and it was looking into what kind of tools is actually used. And here you can see that passive DNS monitoring was one of the least popular tools, but it was also one of the ones that they said, I don't use it, but plan to use it in the future. And I think now almost all teams are using passive DNS and it's become really popular. So it's a way of, I think it's one of the best ways of tracing and tracking and keeping track of more advanced threats. Of course, there are shortcomings in proactive detection. These are some of the ones that are that you can look into. I'm not going to go into all the details because we're running out of time and I want to do a Kahoot quiz. But Security Onion, that is part of your hands-on exercises that I really recommend that you look into. It's not mandatory, but it will help you get a more concrete feel of what incident response is like. It contains actually three different intrusion detection systems and some analysis tools that you can try yourself. Okay, so let's go on to the Kahoot quiz, and one of you will hopefully get a milk chocolate. If someone online wins, unfortunately I cannot send it through the cybers, so then I will let the, give it to the one that is most closely to the top from the classroom. So I'm going to put that on now. I don't know where the sound is here. Okay. Let's put this up. So, seems like it's working. So, good luck. And it's 10 questions today, so. A challenging quiz. Seems like you have some people online too, because I think I see more nicknames here than I have in the classroom right now, so that's good. Is everyone in? Should we start? Okay, I'm starting it now. Good luck. Which one of these teams does not usually offer incident handling services? That's the ISAC. Okay. Bra is in the first place. Name three common roles of staff in CSearch. Why isn't the whole screen showing? Is this better? So 10 had that correct. PSH is in the lead. What kind of CSearch organizational model is this? That's the distributed CSearch. Wow, I'm impressed. LM is in the lead. What CSearch organizational model is suited to serve a diverse and usually external constituency? That's the coordinating CSearch. LM is still in lead, but it's kind of close in the top here. Which of these CSERT services is a proactive service? That's the technology watch. Okay, a lot of you have that wrong. PASH is in the lead. What class of incident indicator is the use of dormant accounts? That's a definite. Still have a PASH in the lead. What class of incident indicator is notification from IDS? That's a probable indicator. Okay, so PSH is really leading now. We still have two questions. What is worse in IDPS, false positives or false negatives? That's the false negatives, the undetected incidents. Wow. Answer streak, that's really good. Question 9, what type of IDPS makes use of a clipping level? That's the anomaly based. Okay, so one more question. What tool would be most useful when dealing with APTs? Advanced Persistent Threats. So, close race between client honeypots and passive DNS. But in my opinion, at least, I think passive DNS is one of the most useful tools. So, let's see who won the chocolate. PSH. Okay. Congratulations. You get the melkerull. And I'll see you all in approximately, I think it's 1 month until next lecture. There you go. It's the winter holiday in between, and also you should work a lot on your project work in between, okay? If you go back to the PowerPoint, this is my recommended reading for the next lecture. I always include this in the end of the lectures so you know what to prepare for next. And we're going to go through some more advanced computer network defense next time. And I'll also go through some quite exciting use cases from real incidents that I've been part of handling when I worked at the CERT. So I'm looking forward to that. See you next time.